You're a SaaS founder. You've built something solid, but growth still feels harder than it should. Most SaaS companies don't fail because of bad tech. They fail because they've never become a must-have to the right customer. This podcast is here to change that. I'm Ton Dobbe, and this is the Remarkable SaaS Podcast. Every week, I talk to founders in the trenches, facing friction, making bold moves, and building companies that last. We dig into real choices around focus, positioning, customer pool, team alignment, the things that separate forgettable software from the ones that people can't live without. No hype, no hacks, just honest conversations to help you build something that people would miss if it was gone. If your SaaS should be indispensable but isn't yet, this is your podcast. Let's get into it. The guest of the podcast this week is Mark Walker, CEO of Nu.
To be great at something, you have to be bad at something else. Like, yes. There are no NFL linemen who are also, you know, world champion marathoners. They're both elite athletes, but they're not the same athlete.
This is Mark. We dig into how we turned a pre-revenue science experiment into a 10 million ARR business by serving the fastest moving AI platforms and obsessively optimizing for their speed. You'll hear how Noi compresses enterprise implementations from years to week, and why they walked away from NVIDIA. The conversation reveals why saying no to the wrong customers is the only way to say yes to the right ones. And what happens when your differentiation is invisible to most buyers, but obvious to your ideal buyer. Well, hi, Mark. Thank you for making the time available today and being the guest on my podcast.
Oh, Ton, my pleasure. Great to meet you.
Yeah, exactly. It's been one that I've been looking forward to for a particular number of reasons. One, given your background in where I also coming from, the ERP world. Mm-hmm. But of course, more recently, what you're doing around billing and how you're creating waves around that particular angle of that many companies are struggling with in terms of the revenue that they are creating. Before we start talking about your company, the company that you're now the CEO of, what drives you? What is giving you energy as an entrepreneur?
I think, you know, once you've been successful a few times, business is about money, but it can't only be about money, right? I don't think it was ever actually only about money for me or for most of the other CEOs I know, particularly the founder CEOs. And so I think, what are the people who like to do this like? Well, number one, they like to do hard things. They like to do it with people who like to do hard things, right? And, you know, people ask me about the stress of what we do, right? Which is to fly without a net and to drive a business faster than any reasonable person would ever try to do. And I sort of analogize it to climbing Everest, that basically, like, complaining about the stress in a startup is like complaining about the snow at the top of Mount Everest. Like, you knew it was there. You stepped over dead bodies to get there, right? And so you have to basically, what I say around the company is, this is too hard not to be fun. So if you're not having fun, you should come and talk to me and we'll talk about how to make it more fun, or maybe you should leave. Because a lot of people around you work incredibly hard and laugh a lot.
Yeah.
And that's a great thing. And sometimes cry a bit. But there's it's a stressful environment. But that, I think, the opportunity to work with incredible people and do incredible things, what could be better in life?
I completely agree. And I mean, the crying can also be of joy. So
Well, every once in a while, it's like, just every once in a while, people do lose it, and being open to understand that we're humans, and sometimes people get to their limit and they need to be able to talk and be able to be not judged for the fact that they have. They've gotten to their, or frankly, they're scared. Sometimes I have to talk people into their ability, and that's interesting.
That's where you grow, right? That's where people, grow fastest themselves, and even in relation to what you want to do as a business. I mean, I love the analogy on the Mount Everest, because indeed that is what you signed up for. You knew the snow was there, and here you had to step over dead bodies. Well, you can see it in front of me. So, talking then, making the bridge to the company, You've been around for a long time in the enterprise software industry, ERP, CRM. You've seen it all happening. NetSuite, as being the company that you work for as a partner in the early days, and yeah, now there's another wave of technology arriving, and it opens up almost the same possibility as what we saw back in the days when yeah, technology enabled enterprise software to go into the cloud. So, tell me a little bit about Nu. What's the big idea behind it?
Right, so I get to brag about this because it's not my idea, right?
No.
So it's actually the creation of an incredible woman named Tina Kung, ex Oracle, ex Salesforce, ex Steelbrick, ex Zuora, right? And what Tina was doing was a different project with the former CTO of Zuora, Cheng Zhu, and they were doing a cash flow management project. But in the course of doing it, they did it properly. The part like business books say you're supposed to do it, where they went out and talked to like 70 CFOs and CROs and asked them a bunch of questions. And the same thing that happened to me in my last startup happened to them, where somebody said, Yeah, that's really interesting. But I have a bleeding neck wound of a problem here, right? And they explained what that was. And the problem was the disconnected nature of CPQ and billing and self-service systems was causing a great deal of friction as these companies tried to either integrate new revenue models or potentially test and adapt revenue models, because you basically would be unable to do that without making all three systems work in the same way. And so the big idea, the big vision that Tina had and she talked to me about was that, to say very simply, quoting is configuring billing. And in a multi-revenue model, multi-channel, business model world, that's going to have to be actually true. Because if it's not actually true, you're going to get revenue leakage and you're actually going to be stopped. And this is, of course, this was in 2020 when she started doing the development, when I met her in 2022. This is right before ChatGPT. This is like right before she was explaining it to me. And she said, Mark, the pace of change of the pace of change has changed. Like, it used to be that you could plan your, take a year to set up one of the systems and a year to integrate into another system. And then you could do like semi-annual or annual reviews. That is going to go away. In fact, it already is going to, it always has gone away in the fastest moving companies. And so the vision of Nu was to build a single system that would do the entire thing. To do that in a way that enabled it to, while it had a single data model, it didn't have a single architecture, so that it would be, the billing system is massively scalable, AWS, but the front end is very, very, very tightly integrated into Salesforce, and the self-serve is really optimized for very high performance, low latency transactions. And so you do all those things at the same time. So just that. But so that vision allowed us to raise, a $15 million seed, and now we can talk more about where the company's gotten to, but it's kind of bonkers where we've gotten to now.
Yeah, exactly. So I mean, thanks for giving this insight in terms of how it all started. And when you started talking 2020, that wasn't where you actually entered the company. You entered the company, what I've seen, in March 2022. Why was that?
Oh, actually, I didn't know. She started in 2020. I met her in March 2022.
Okay.
And a VC asked me to t said, "Do you want to be a CEO again?" I'm like, "No, I want to go kiteboarding." And then he said, "Well, would you?" And then I met Tina, and she's incredible. And I first said, and then my reaction was, "Why aren't you the CEO?" And the last thing a talented woman needs is, an older guy, the boss. And we became friends. And she said, "Look, this lift is so big technically, and so important what we're doing, is I need someone to run the bit to lead the business." And we became very good partners and very good friends.
So you became the CEO in March 2022. What was the situation with the company back then? Where was it? And then in comparison to where it is right now?
I would describe it as, politely as pre-revenue, and And so more bluntly, as a science experiment. In other words, the company had been given great funding. At that point, only about $6 million of funding. I raised a bunch of money right after that. But and to really see if this problem could actually be practically solved. Like I don't mean a science experiment in really a brave way, where some investors had such faith in Chung, and because Chung decided to pursue Tina's vision, such faith in Tina that they did properly capitalize it to do an MVP. And then the company had focused very carefully on building out the entire infrastructure, but then productizing the CPQ. And they were just at the point where they needed to commercialize it. And I walked in and said, okay, whatever it does, we're selling that. Let's go. And so that was the inflection point. So I think the inflection point would have been crossed. I know it would have been anyway if I hadn't shown up. I just showed up and maybe added a fairly high degree of aggression to the whole thing.
So pre-revenue, also pre-customer.
They actually had non-paying customers. They had it's very difficult to build and test one of these systems. So, eternal gratitude to the original Avail and Betterworks and a few other people, Demostack, who were the very first customers. I always say, God bless the first people who buy enterprise software.
True.
If nobody buys it, doesn't go
Yeah, true.
anywhere, but the people who buy it, they deserve our eternal respect. Those people are looking out for their industry. They're investing in all of us, and I have all the time in the world for every single person that I've ever sold early versions of software to.
Yeah, the innovators that are prepared to take the big risks at the end. Yeah, exactly. So now what I've seen is you are around 100 customers and around 10 million revenue. That was for a
Yeah,
while,
we're
I think.
closing in on it. We're not quite there yet, but
Okay,
we will be very
but
quickly,
close enough. So a lot of things happens in barely 3 years. How did you what did you do to get that traction going? Because I mean, a lot of customer, a lot of people that I work with, people that are on my podcast, I mean, the traction is always the hardest part, and especially when you get towards 10 million in 3 years' time. That is that's remarkable, I would say.
Yeah, so first of all, you have to have a business plan. You have to really understand what your business plan is. And, from our perspective, even though in a perfect world we'd like to take out, and we often do take out the entire infrastructure for a company, DNT, Muse, PDQ, Chili Piper, a bunch of those examples. We deliberately set up a situation in which the customer didn't have to choose to get rid of all their existing infrastructure. So they could buy our CPQ without buying, and they could buy our CPQ, they could buy our CPQ in self-service, sort of like self-service to order. And they could just use this effectively as a billing backend, which Bench did before they sort of catastrophically decompressed. But so this modularity that was extensible really helped us penetrate customers really, really quickly. The second thing was that we continued this tradition of listening really, really well. And so we went out and were very fortunate to be able to create relationships and do business with the major AI platforms. I can now, so the first time I can tell people that Anthropic has agreed to for us to be able to tell people that they were not only one of our customers, but they were one of the design customers for our agentic solutions. And we will also be supporting Anthropic models. Of course, OpenAI is as well, but everybody already knows about OpenAI. So the news is Anthropic. But very purposefully, we targeted to make sure we understood our ability to serve the future business models and not focus so much on the past. And so having OpenAI, Anthropic, Glean, Jasper, Legora, and soon everybody else you've ever heard of in enterprise AI, at least running our CPQ. I can't really talk about what everybody's running, but people running different ways, using a different our systems in different ways, but is a monumental driver of business. And why? Because people basically presume that they don't know what's about to happen next, but they're pretty sure that the large AI companies have both a better window on it and will hit that window first. And from what we're seeing, they're absolutely right that these people are innovating at a pace that normal companies just even couldn't sustain.
Yeah, true.
And that's super exciting.
Yeah. So that's, yeah, I mean, it's almost maybe taking one of my questions out that I normally ask, like, what has been an early decision on this journey that appeared to be, yeah, almost a home run, or that has defined the success that you're seeing today? Is that the things that you just talked about, or is it maybe something else as well?
I think the decision to build, to do everything that we did at an extreme level of quality and to make each piece of it independently amazing is another one. And to do that, to be great at something, you have to be bad at something else. Like there
Yes.
are no, NFL linemen who are also world champion marathoners. They're both elite athletes, but they're not the same athlete, right? So for us, the decision to abandon a lot of the complexity, for example, Salesforce RCA has 27 object pricing model, right? And the reason for that is to support helicopter parts or something, configurable dishwashers, which is not a problem that our target customers, which who are, recurring revenue companies of all types, but particularly including the high growth SaaS and the divisions of larger companies. We do $1 billion companies using this that are like that with recurring or hybrid, physical goods plus services, those sort of things. In for us to serve those people incredibly quickly with very, very short time to value, OpenAI 8 weeks, Anthropic 12 weeks, Chili Piper 13 weeks, Exonify accidentally went live during training. Like this kind of velocity, which we think is critical for today,
Yeah.
you have to discard a whole bunch of functionality that takes you out of the market. So if somebody went Dell Computers, actually, NVIDIA did come to us. Imagine how painful this conversation is. NVIDIA comes to us and we love what you do. We go, yeah, you won't love us in 2 years. This is not the right solution for you. We maybe could be able to help your software division. But we are not the right people for this. Can we go over and talk to you about Logic? Let's introduce you to people at Logic. Again, don't shit can your competitors. Logic's a great company with a dude that does something different than us, And so we suggested they went. I'm pretty sure they are that NVIDIA is a Logic customer right now, or they took a serious look at it anyway. And
Yeah.
that was a good decision for them. But for us, it's the decision to focus on our ICP, which is effectively our peers, right? And those billion-dollar scale versions of our peers, and to focus on saying the most fundamental feature that the customer wants out of these systems is speed. Speed and flexibility is just a form of speed, right? So they want to be able to get live in weeks, means that you can change it in weeks. And that's the fundamental. That's why we won them all, by the way. That focus is why we won everybody.
Let me make a small interruption here. Mark just made an excellent remark that sets Noy's product strategy apart from conventional enterprise thinking. He explained that to achieve the velocity customers need today, you have to discard functionality that will take you out of the market. Most vendors try to serve everyone by adding features. Mark did the opposite. He threw out entire use cases. When NVIDIA came to them, he said no. Not because the technology couldn't handle it, but because serving that customer would slow down everyone else. That's a trade-off most founders won't make. They want velocity and universal appeal. Mark proved you only get speed by deliberately limiting who you serve. This is what remarkable SaaS companies do. They acknowledge they cannot please everyone. They offer something valuable and desirable, and then they aim to be different, not just better. Want to master these traits as well? Simply read my book. I've made the electronic version available for free. Just visit theremarkableeffect.com to grab your copy, and inspiration will spark within 10 minutes. Back to the interview. Fascinating that you talk about this and that you gave this exact example. I mean, I wrote my book, The Remarkable Effect. That's about the 10 traits of remarkable software companies. And the first trait is exactly what you talked about. It's remarkable software companies acknowledge that they cannot please everyone. And you gave an example that a lot of SaaS entrepreneurs are super scared of saying no to big deals. And they'll always try to make it work. And the moment you have the guts to say, no, it's not going to work, go to my competitor, that's where your real power starts to shine. And that was
Yeah.
what you did here.
Yeah. I mean, we don't say no to big. We say no to wrong big. Like,
Yeah, exactly.
there inside our ICP, there are people with inside our customer base, there are people with billions and billions and billions of dollars, like running through our systems, right?
True.
They're using exactly the same software that our little startup people who go through our quick start program are using. What's really interesting is that when you build software really, really well, you can find some people who are in the first group who kind of act like the second group and are able to move super, super quickly. But generally, that's not true. Generally, most of the companies up in the, $500 million or more, they couldn't clean their bathrooms in 8 weeks. Never mind, it's organizational change. They could clean them. They couldn't move them or whatever. But there are still companies in that group where you look at them and you go, yeah, we're just not going to go pursue those companies because even though they look in other ways exactly like us, we know that the organizational load of dealing with them. So for that, we are building out really strong SI partnerships and let the SIs go chase those companies because those companies will want to be like pet and stroked and cuddled and managed, and they need services that we just don't provide. And so that's the other thing. As a company, figure out what your business is, and it doesn't, you don't have to serve all the needs of a market. You just say we're the technology vendor and let's produce the SI relationships to deal with the bigger customers.
That's the way to go about it, indeed. At the end, it comes down to differentiation, right? And the CPQ space is busy enough. The billing space is busy enough. And you need to find your sweet spot. And I think that's what you were just talking about. Now, talking about differentiation, understanding where the differentiation plays out, what have you done since you joined to strengthen that moat, so to say, creating defensible differentiation?
Well, I'm loath to take credit for anything we've done directly because, like you said, I think we can only talk about it. It's a team sport, and so if we clarify that the you is us as a team, then I can talk more freely. I think, me as a leader, what have I done? Ask questions of people who are very smart and ask them in the right time. But I think the big thing was in differentiation. So, for example, Nu is headless in the most extreme sense, in the sense that you literally don't need an application on the front end at all. You can build your own application and people do, right? But it's simultaneously also productized at an extreme level, right? And how can those two things be true? So, when we productized the front end, particularly the CPQ front end, people have described it as Salesforce the way you wish it was, or NetSuite redesigned by HubSpot, right? Or just a beautiful user-centric application. I think Craig Rosenberg at Scale said it was the best CPQ ever built for sellers, right? Even if you didn't have a billing system, it was still so beautifully designed for sellers. And so this differentiation allows us to win really, really quickly. But the real differentiation, so the first thing people see is this, wow, this thing is gorgeous. And oh, by the way, it is completely extensible at an extreme level. Like you can extend it just like anything else in Salesforce. But the real differentiation is actually the unified data model, because it means that we really do have an enterprise-grade billing engine off the other side of this thing. And so basically in Nu, anything you can quote, you can bill. But even more than that, anything you quote, you can change in self-service with exactly the same functionality. Now, you may choose not to give, the customer the ability to do a sudden swap out of two complex packages in the middle of, in the middle of their contract. The functionality in the CPQ and the functionality in their self-service is, for all intents and purposes, exactly the same. It's also blindingly fast because of the architecturally was built to be, build your pricing in one place, execute it anywhere, including actually in other systems. And so when you request pricing from new, you don't get the pricing, you get the pricing engine. You get actually the code for calculating the price. Makes it tremendously flexible. So these differentiation points matter to different customers, to smaller companies, the idea that they can implement one system in hours, like in a few days or a few weeks, and they could never outgrow that system and never actually have any limits to their business is tremendously attractive. We price it very, very favorably for those companies. We want those successes. And then, but for our scale companies, people are paying us, extremely large amounts of money because of their very big problem. What they want is literally no limits on how they could use it. So they could, they use it as CPQ, they use it as a billing system, they use it as any part of the billing system, they use it as a quarterback of multiple different other billing systems, they use it in a headless way, they're creating data islands off the data coming out of this. Oh no, what I actually want to do is I actually want to create, a Node.js server that actually executes pricing for like Amazon or something, whatever they want. That's the big, so it's different markets. The one thing that's simple is for the bottom end of the market, and the simple thing that's complex is for the top end of the market. Make sense?
And the key word here for both is speed.
Speed,
And
yeah.
that goes back to your to the segmentation, because speed, the way you can offer it, is not for everybody, Some people could say, yeah, it's nice that it's got the speed, but they won't appreciate it as much as the other ones. And this is where pricing power comes in place, right?
Yeah, I think actually that's changing. I think that, like I said before, the pace of change has changed, right? And the thing we were changing, by the way, pace of the thing in that sentence was speed. Like, so the pace of change of the pace of change of speed has changed. And this has been the impact of generative AI, but also other forms of AI and machine learning. And I think that right now, we are getting calls from people who run extremely conventional businesses who are sitting there going, okay, I have no idea what's about to happen, but I'm pretty sure that having 20-year-old technology is probably not a very good idea. And I'm pretty sure that owning the technology that all the AI companies think is fast enough and adaptable for them. So I would like to look at this. My question for you is, are you functionally deep enough to handle our business? And in some cases, honestly, the answer is no. But in most cases, the answer is yes. And so, speed, even if you're not ready, I mean, let's put it this way, even if you don't think you're going to use a parachute, you should probably bring one on a biplane. Right? Right? And so, we're getting an awful lot of companies who are coming to us because they are getting ready for what's about to happen. What I think if you don't think that the software industry is going to change and technology generally in the next change radically in the next 3 years, you have your head in the sand, and your business is probably going to go bankrupt, right?
That's true.
Because I think what'll happen is it's not that AI will make your business bankrupt. It's because other people who successfully and fully adopt AI in their businesses will be able to hyper compete with you, and that's and I'm not, I'm being flippant about the bankrupt part. Obviously, if you have a scaled multi-billion-dollar company, take an awfully long time to go to zero. But you could end up in a situation quite quickly where you can't attract capital. And that's happening. We're seeing that starting to happen now, and that trend is happening. So companies, by moving, we're getting more very high C-level conversations where people are coming in saying, look, we need to look at the systems we need for the future. And the fact that we can stand this up really quickly, and the fact that we've run in parallel with our existing systems, and we can start to make experiments and bets, this is important to our business. And so it's really interesting because the three cohorts, right? Little tiny companies, they just want to get something done, right? Medium-sized companies, they have specific things they want to fix. They had PLG, they want to bring it together with SLG, and they very specific, or M&A activities, very specific. And the scaled companies, it's pure, they're getting ready to deal with hyper change. And that's why they're switching their systems. And it's a slower decision for sure, but speed is almost the only thing they want to talk about. Yeah.
I can
Does that
imagine
make sense?
specifically for them. Yeah, it makes total sense. Yeah, exactly. Now, talking about this, the speed, the change of The
pace of
pace
change has changed. Yeah.
of course, it also applies to yourself because the number of agentic companies, or at least companies that claim that they have the agentic angle to it, is exploding. I mean, I've had a number of them on my podcast. Talking about these trade-offs that you said you made around who you serve and who you don't serve, how far does that go to those trade-offs that you made? And do you also use it cleverly or smartly to ensure that you stay ahead of the market?
Yeah, that's a really good point. Right. In other words, the filtering is really prioritization, right? And we're constantly running new ideas through this. When a lot of people are going to market, first of all, there is so much more sizzle than steak in agentic, right? And so a lot of people are talking about it. Frankly, a lot of the talk is optimistic, let's put it that way. It's optimistic, trying to be polite. But we're a very, very deliberate company that, with one of the reasons we won some of these logos, we were seen as not only the most advanced vendor, but the most honest vendor. And we take great pride in that as a company. Have a compassion for the decision that your customer is making and how important and how devastating this will be to their career if it's the wrong decision, even if your technology is great, but it was the wrong decision for them. Let's have frank conversations, right? So our agentic, we had the great honor of designing our agentic with both the guidance and the participation of the major model vendors who are actually the first customers for this, right? And so our view of it is, and some people, I can't speak for any of them particularly or disclose private conversations, but some of the conversations have been in the order of, this is the most advanced agentic ever we've ever seen in any enterprise application ever. Now, why? Right.
Which is the ever part.
Yeah. It's like, why? It's like for, so far, right? And so why? It's because the APIs, if you design a system that was really easy for people to use that compresses all the complexity into APIs so they actually don't have to figure out how to prorate stuff and all that sort of stuff, guess what? It's really easy for agents to use too. So it's like an emergent property of that. And so we're seeing our deal close rates go through the roof because people go, they see two things. One is our agentic design to massively accelerate enablement. Remember, speed, 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 right? You don't really need to train someone to do anything other than the one or two, three things they do on a regular basis, and everything else can be they can do agentically. But the second part is our agentic is extensible in a way that you can program experiences with it. So you can say, think of it like a new API, and you go, oh, actually, I want a button here that does this particular thing, but I'm not actually going to describe how to do it in code. I'm just going to tell the agent to do it. Like that's what all the button does, says, renew this at a 5% uplift, right? Like, and that's really easy because you can literally write renew this at a 5% uplift is your prompt, and the agentic does it perfectly, right? As opposed to go get the data, put, go make sure you've got the great data model, go check the rules and all this sort of stuff, and go programmatically do it, which our APIs support, but you don't need to do that anymore. So I think that when we think about this, we think about agentic as changing the way software is built. And the most extreme version of that is our self-service. All of our self-service implementations are now built using essentially AI. Like we don't, I mean, people, some people do actually write code, but we don't. So we just go, here, this is what your website looks like. This is the experience you want. Let's prompt it. There you go. Bam. There's your entirely built out self-service stack. Right. So that's that. I hope I answered your
Yeah,
question.
definitely, definitely. It is about prioritization, but you said something very important there, because everybody indeed is screaming and the noise is incredible. So I can really imagine, that's also what I experienced myself at the end, that honesty is sort of the lever these days. Just no bullshit. This is what it is. This is what it's not about. Your example also about, yes, we could potentially technically help you or functionality help you, but we don't because you're not gonna sustain with this for 1 or 2 years. You're gonna churn at the end because the system is not built for you. All of that honesty allows you to create the best decisions, and then that is felt in everything. So yeah, I completely agree with that. And I think that's also what you see on your website, and then how people behave, because it's the right way to do it at the end. Given what you just said about how simple it is to change things, to get things organized, one thing, of course, that also does is that it's not something that that is system out of the box. It's driven by the creativity of people. How do you go about that? Because I mean, people then
Well,
are getting super creative, and they're gonna see all the edges of the system.
yeah, so it is an interesting problem because I can more or less talk about our customers in three groups. People who have no system, right? The startups, I mean, spreadsheets are not a system. I mean, they are in a sense, but they have no system. People who hate their existing system, and people who, or for whom it's very problematic, let's put it that way, and people who are defensively migrating, right? Now, if you think about the first one and the third one, they're actually the simplest groups of people to deal with. So, for example, if you're running, Salesforce Revenue Cloud, and you decide you don't want to be here anymore because they don't sell it anymore, and you don't want to go to the replacement product because very few people are really doing well there, or you don't think it's a good fit for you, or whatever. And they come over to new, we can basically say, well, look, if you're well set up, the migration path can be incredibly short. So we're going to take a $300 million company from Revenue Cloud to live on new with billing in like 4 months, right? And a month of that is testing, right? So, and the same thing on the other side, like if you're a little kid, a little small company, like our size of company, you can probably get set up in a few days, right? And it won't be wrong. In the middle, though, are the people who actually think that the way they were running things was completely wrong. And so one of the innovations we introduced to them was the opportunity to send them through training before they started the project. So instead of actually going, oh, I didn't know about that in the middle of the project. By the way, everybody else can go through training too, but it's really designed for these group of people. Because then you go in and you go and we can have a conversation together about what the future state might look like. Because migrating the present state would be like migrating QuickBooks into NetSuite. You're just going to have like a dumbed down NetSuite, right? And obviously there's so many other tools as well. So the same thing would be true. If you take literally one system you didn't like and you move it into another system for, exactly similarly, you'll miss some things. And so this has been very, very well received. That's part of it. The other part of it is that middle complexity is where our SIs thrive. So our solution architecture teams ride along with them. They definitely do the training. We ride along with them. And often what it is cleaning up all the customization that you did to make this other system work. And so you just have to understand that everybody's on the same journey and that the best way to get through a project really quickly is empower the customers, bring them onto your team. We have a bunch of customers who are involved in that, doing that right now.
Makes total sense, and I like that's a flexible approach again that you have for different people, because at the end, different people, I mean, not every company, even though they look the same on the outside, are the same on the inside, and that's where the nuance kicks in.
Right, for sure. You have the same revenue and sell in the same sector, but one of you grew organically and the other one grew
Exactly.
by acquisition, and you could have a completely different migration scenario in those two things.
Well, that's exactly what I wanted to go with that. Because you're talking about your prioritization. A part of prioritization when it comes to product strategy, of course, like what do you build yourself? And then, of course, what do you partner for? And this way, you've already talked about a couple of your technology partners. But the other thing is, of course, also, and I know that you've done a good number of those in the past, acquisitions. And you recently acquired Approvals Pro, March. Why did you decide to kind of go and acquire a company like Approvals Pro rather than build it yourself?
Speed. Speed. Look, first of all, the team over there had done an amazing job. It's by far the most advanced approval tool in the Salesforce ecosystem. It is not restricted It works with all the standard objects, but it's not restricted to the standard objects. You can build approval paths that have to do with transactions completely unrelated to, so you can use it like for data quality approvals against the account object, or complex multi-step approval processes around, so for example, solution design and those sort of things. And people were already using it. Technically, their customer base was kind of amazing, right? So, and this little tiny company had like Telus and Fonterra Butter and like all these people who weren't in our ICP at all, but it showed the quality of the product that they had built. And it, certainly it's no problem. We turn around to one of our hyperscale companies and they go, "Well, who else is using it?" And we go, "Telus and Nokia and right, and then those sort of things, right?" And then finally, Guy and the team over there had done an amazing job listening to their customer, and so it was a great acquisition for us. Now we're working with it now. The next version, all of our, going. I can't say specific things, but you can imagine who these people might have been who said, "Oh, by the way, we have a hyperscaling company, and actually being able to agentically enable approvals and be able to make provide more information in the approval process, even potentially clear some approvals agentically, would be super, super valuable to us." And so it was really a great framework, and we are now building on top of it. And it will be a critical part of both our agentic, the straight agentic approval process, the and but also our we have a product coming out called Jurecheck, which actually is integrating the contract lifecycle management into the approval process, because right, they're not two things, right? The one thing has to match the other thing. Hey, the quote should match the terms of the contract, but it's also, automatically deciding on the approval path that a certain red line needs to go down. Like, so for example, if you red line it to say, "I'd like to switch the state from California to New York," we might not care, right? They're both, great litigation, great jurisdictions to do business in. If you say, "I want to switch it to Missouri," no harm, no thing on Missouri, but people generally don't pick Missouri as a jurisdiction for this sort of thing. And so therefore some companies might care, some companies might not. A different level of approval is required. So that's, so we wanted to own it so we could innovate it. That's basically that's a short answer.
Yeah, I understand that because there's so much to it. But there's always this balance of, okay, what do you build, what do you buy, and what do you partner for? And this was one of these examples. And because the other thing is, of course, also, and you know that maybe as good or maybe better than I do, that acquiring something, of course, is not only about, okay, technology is a great fit. You're also buying all the people and all the thinking and all the other things that could also play a risk to the company. So how do you go about that?
Well, actually, in that acquisition, we didn't buy any of the people. We sort of rented the people, but we were planning to bring. Look, it's Salesforce-based code. We have a complete ability to understand it, particularly in a world in the world of Claude and ChatGPT. It's no longer the case that you have to put somebody in a room and go, "Hey, go read all the documentation and read the code and see what it does." You can now very quickly run code quality scans and other things, and very quickly grok the product. And this wasn't a question of us, not wanting their team. We would have welcomed their team. Their team had a different mission, and them divesting this was part of the was one of the steps in that. And so again, if you want to have great partners, be a great partner. We've talked about how we would do that, and it's been a very effective partnership for us. By way of contrast, the little company we bought that will become Jurecheck, that was literally buying a person, like buying a person who was we thought was amazing, and he had this project, and to get the person we had to basically take the project, and we wanted the project anyway. So it was so it's a win-win-win-win-win, and about people. And we have some things coming up that are much more about buying market share. So the acquisitions that are focused in different objectives have different characteristics. Like if I'm buying market share, I just made an offer yesterday to buy a company, and I probably will need some of their people for a while, but I'm really buying their customer base versus some other things we're looking at. We'll definitely need people and engineering depth to take that on. And yeah, but people try to buy us all the time, and like, no, we're in acquisition mode. Like, it's like, yeah.
Exactly. That's where you make another important decision, talking about where companies go these days. And one of the metrics that I've become a big fan of over time is ARR per employee. I mean, you're doing 10 million. What I've seen is you got about 110, 120 people. How is that lever going to, well, how do you plan to make that lever go? Because you said, we need people, we need people. Is it always about people to grow, or is it, are you trying to, I mean, is your strategy, how is your strategy around it?
Yeah, so the our focus this year was not so much on the actual end number. It was actually on basically enablement and speed, enablement and speed, and taking out a few specific customers that we really wanted, like Anthropic. We're probably at, in different departments, approaching peak department size. Certainly not in the sales department, but in the PS team, it'll continue to go up, but it won't go up as anywhere near, because what we've been doing for the past year is hiring the people who are going to support the people who are actually going to implement the software. And so more and more SIs are coming to us because basically the alternative technologies are so difficult to implement, and so therefore so difficult to scope. And frankly, if they get into a competition with us and they end up on the other side of that thing. I'll give you an example. I can't tell you which technology company. One of the deals we won, we were almost exactly the same price in terms of technology as the very large vendor we beat. And so, it was Salesforce, right? And but the project time frame and the implementation cost was so massively different that it was basically almost determinative. Right. It was like we actually padded ours because we knew we just wanted to be sensible. So they came in at six times our padded quote. Right. And look, we're giving the customer a ton of value because we got through this implementation so fast, we couldn't even possibly have burned even like the padded that our very, reduced quote. And so we're just pouring money and throwing services into them in other ways that helps them expand and be more successful. But of course, if you were the SI on the other side of that, you had zero, like zero. You did all this work and you got absolutely nothing out of it. And I think they're starting to decide that maybe that's not a good equation to be in. But it's hard because, if you think your business is putting keys, fingers on keys, that's over.
It's
Like that's
over.
over, right? Like companies like us and frankly, Rillet and a whole bunch of other people are driving down, double click or double entry rather. They're driving down this implementation cycle in a way that's going to wipe out. So these companies really need to rethink what it is they do, and we're also rethinking about from their point of view. And really, the advice, going back to that example you were talking about, the advice about what to do is incredibly valuable, right? The actual doing of it, not so much anymore.
That's true. Yeah. Fascinating how that's still the case, that these companies think that the way they have been doing this for the last 2 decades is still relevant, and still think they can get away with it. Maybe with a couple of them they can, but these days will be over.
You know what? I don't think we should think of this derisively. I've talked to CEOs of many of these companies. They're venerated firms who are extremely professional and do amazing work with the technology that was available at the time. There's new technology. And their number one concern isn't, how am I going to pay for my Porsche? Their major concern is, I have all these people who have been in my organization whom I love, and I'm going to have to let them go, and I don't know what to tell them.
True. Yeah,
Right.
exactly.
Like, in
Yeah.
other words, I don't actually have a lot of conversation with like arrogant people. Like, what are you doing? You think you can do what I do? Look, no, they actually are steely-eyed about what's going on and very upset and trying to understand. And they say, Mark, how can we think about how we would use these types of people in this new era? Can we have a conversation about that? And it's as a business leader, it's frankly inspiring to see that all these people, what they're mostly concerned about is their teams. And
Exactly.
actually, it makes me a bit choked up. I think I really respect it.
Yeah, that's true. Completely agree. Looking at the time, yeah, if you look at your entire career, maybe possibly the last 3 years in specifically, what would be a do and what would be a don't in terms of a lesson that you'd like to share with other entrepreneurs that are aspiring, yeah, similar success, similar journey?
The do would be fearlessly reimagine an existing market is a better idea than creating an entirely new market. Now, there's lots of exceptions to that, right? ChatGPT, Anthropic being good examples, and frankly, a number of different people that enter that market, following them, think Cursor and Lovable and Bolt, who really entered a market that is so different that it's almost like a new market, but it really wasn't a new market. It was really a very, very accelerated form of IDE, an integrated development environment, right?
Yeah,
So,
true.
but entering an existing market and making it better is much more profitable than, and even though it's harder than starting something completely raw, unless you happen to be a visionary genius, and I've never considered myself a visionary genius. The don't would be, I've always struggled with the edges of discipline. I would say, don't let your ambition outstrip your focus. Right? It's so easy to do. I battle with it every day. People come to me all the time, go, "Can we do this with you? Can we do that with you? Can we do this with you?" And the power of no is a very important one.
Couldn't have said it better myself. I think this is yeah, this is what people need to hear. And the question, of course, is then, okay, yeah, maybe we've heard it 15 times, but the art is in the doing, and start practicing it with the small things that you have on your desk every day. Good. Well, so where can people go to find out more about Nu, or to say hi to you?
Obviously you can find me on LinkedIn. If you want to sell me something, just tell me you want to sell me something. We'll get back to you. Like, don't beat around the bush. I'm super busy, and if I don't really understand what you want, I won't engage. But I'm much more interested in understanding if there's any way I can help you, in a non I'm a CEO. I don't buy anything, by the way, guys. Like, I don't buy anything very much. But the company is nu.io, NUE.io. It couldn't be shorter, right? And
Lovely.
look, even if you're not looking to switch out your systems right now, very few people have looked at nu and said, "Wow, that wasn't interesting." So if you want to come and see a demo and you want to just tell us straight out, "Hey, we don't really have a project right now." Our team's used to that. They will treat you with respect, and they won't just, like, BDR you off into a corner or something. So,
Okay, that's also about being approachable.
yeah.
And being humble, and I think that it's what I've heard throughout the whole conversation. I mean, I'm really looking forward to how this company is going to evolve and rethink, fearlessly reimagine what this market is all about, because it is ripe for that. Thanks for sharing all of this. Thanks.
Don, thank you so much for the time. I really enjoyed our conversation.
Likewise. And this wraps up my conversation with Mark Walker, CEO of Noi. If you got value from this episode, please share it with other SaaS founders who need to hear this as well. And if you got 10 seconds, a quick rating or review on Apple Podcasts will help more people to find these conversations. Thank you for listening to the Remarkable SaaS Podcast. If you want more insights like this, subscribe to my daily email, Espresso with Tom. It's a 2-minute shot of clarity for SaaS founders who want to create pull, not push. You can sign up, along with getting my book, at valueinspiration.com. See you in the next episode.